This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Nick Reiner, the son of Hollywood icon Rob Reiner, in court on double murder charges in the last hours. This is, we learn, he is writing a tell-all book about his parents' deep, dark Hollywood secrets, writing it from behind bars. What? Well, he's in court, triple shackled, and showing no remorse. Good evening. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us.
He struggled with mental health issues most of his life. He struggled with a lot. There were times when some things that he said were just a little odd. It's just unthinkable. It's unfathomable. These are two parents that were absolutely fantastic, were loving, compassionate.
Joining us live at the courthouse, Crime Stories investigative reporter Alexis Tereshchuk. Alexis, what happened? First of all, was Nick Reiner behind a glass cage, or was he seated, flanked by his lawyers in court?
He was seated, flanked by his lawyer in court. This is the first hearing that he's had where he was not behind protective glass. A sheriff put gloves on, went in the back, escorted him out. He was wearing a yellow prison shirt, very baggy yellow prison shirt, blue prison pants, and then his arms were shackled around the wrist to his waist. He walked to the seat next to his attorney and sat down there facing the judge.
Tell me, which attorneys were flanking him in court?
He actually sat next to Kimberly Green, his public defender.
Guys, joining us at the courthouse, Alexis Tereshchuk, with the latest on Nick Reiner in court. We're going to get to his tell-all book that he is penning behind bars about his dead parents that he reportedly murdered in their sleep, slitting their throats. This sounds like a Hollywood screenplay. We have a preliminary hearing to set up a preliminary hearing. That's how they talk to each other. I'll have my agent call your agent. My people call your people. We'll have a call to set up a call. Why did we have a preliminary hearing to set up a preliminary hearing, Alexis Tereshchuk? What happened?
So what happened was the defense says they are still waiting on discovery from the prosecution. They said they still are waiting for this, and they therefore could not do the preliminary hearing today because they don't have all of the evidence yet.
Alexis Tereshchuk, who else was in the courtroom? Did Reiner's family show up?
There were no family members in the courtroom today. It was just reporters, the spokesperson from the district attorney's office. That was it. He had no family support there today.
Did he look around to see if family was there? What was his demeanor?
When he walked into the courtroom, he looked out into the gallery. He looked to see who was there, see if anybody. He then sat down with his attorney. At that point, he looked straight forward the entire time. At one point, he leaned over to whisper to his attorney, and then he sort of looked back behind him into the courtroom. But the rest of the time, he was facing forward. Very stoic look on his face. No emotion whatsoever.
Okay, does that include remorse?
Correct. When the judge asked him if he understood what was going on, he said, yeah. Then he asked him again, do you agree that this is what's going on? The judge explained that it's part of the legal system that he has to agree to postpone the preliminary hearing, and it enters into certain times, and it was a bit of a complicated discussion. And so he leaned over to his attorney, who kind of whispered to him and explained basically that we're not doing the preliminary hearing today. We're moving the date to another date in September. Even then, that's not the preliminary hearing. That's when we're going to set a date for the preliminary hearing. And then he said, yeah, back to the judge. And one more time, the judge said, okay, so do you understand everything? And he said, yeah.
So clearly understanding what was going on. Philip Dubay joining me from this jurisdiction of L.A. He is a former court-appointing counsel there in L.A. County Public Defender's Office, which means he has tried a lot of cases, all of them as a defense attorney, including homicide cases. Dubay, thank you for being with us tonight. This is significant. It's got to be on the record. There has to be a court reporter writing it all down, every single word, precisely for appellate reasons if there ever is a conviction, because In our jurisprudence, under American law, you have a right to a hearing, an in-court hearing before an impartial magistrate, where you are kept apprised of everything that's happening in your case. In this case, there is a delay in the preliminary hearing. And in our system, you have a right to be read your indictment, know what you're being charged with, confront witnesses against you, have a right to cross-examine them. You have a right to review scientific evidence, such as the autopsy reports, and you get to find out all about the witnesses and their locations in case you want to interview them. That is why it was very important that he be advised there was going to be a delay in that preliminary hearing.
That's exactly right, Nancy. In California, every criminal defendant charged with a felony has a statutory right to a speedy preliminary hearing, and that ultimately means that the defendant has the right to have his prelim within 10 court days of arraignment. However, the defendant can waive that statutory period and ask for more time. So when he was arraigned in February through his counsel, they asked for a preliminary hearing setting, which is a fancy way of saying a pre-prelim hearing, almost like a pre-trial hearing for today, as a 0 of 30, meaning he has 30 court days from today to have his preliminary hearing, unless he again wishes for more time. And through his counsel, they asked for yet another continuance because they don't have everything. And Nancy, I can tell you just historically, nobody goes to prelim so quickly from the date of arraignment in a murder. It usually takes almost a year before both sides have everything and are ready to proceed.
To Alexis Tereshchuk, joining us at the courthouse, investigative reporter, Crime Stories. Had his appearance changed since the last time you observed him?
He still has very sunken eyes. He looks very, and he's very, very, very pale. But he has the same shaved head. Every time he's been in court since the first time, he has a shaved head. He has a bit of facial hair on his chin with a mustache. But he looks the same. He looks round. He doesn't look muscular. He's a very big guy, and he walks very, stoically into the room. He shuffles in or walks in. But he just has these very dark circles under his eyes.
You stated that he looked round?
He doesn't look like he's been working out. He just looks sort of like he's a round guy, kind of puffy, a little bit of puffy skin, just a bigger guy.
So, needless to say, he has not missed a meal behind bars. Okay, I'm glad to hear that because I don't want to hear any whining about the jailhouse food, especially when you're used to having a private chef and raiding your parents' Sub-Zero fridge anytime you feel like it. So, his appetite is good. You stated he looked like a big guy. To special guest joining us, Heather Michaels, she is a Reiner family friend and neighbor. She is also an investigative reporter, a producer, and she is a social justice advocate. A big guy, round, not the kind of face, not the kind of guy you want to see standing over your bed at 3 a.m. in the dark, I take it?
Correct.
How does it strike you that all this fuss is made about Nick Reiner? What is he wearing? If you look at practically any article online about what happened today in the last hours, we hear a fashion review. What he's wearing, how does he look, what was his demeanor? It's all about him. Nothing about Rob Reiner or Michelle Singer. Nothing.
Right, and you can imagine the living nightmare the siblings are going through every moment of every day and every time that this gets continued and, this is drawn out. And then the talk about this tell-all book, it's a living nightmare. It's so traumatic for the other siblings.
Heather Michaels, guys, joining us. You can find her at Heather Michaels TV, neighbor of the Reiners. I know that you read brother Jake Reiner's essay, and it just broke my heart when I read the part where he said, well, I'll quote it, "The 45-minute Lyft ride from downtown to the west side was unendurable. My world as I knew it collapsed. I was in a trance. The only thing I could focus on was that I needed to get to my childhood home. I needed to get to my sister. I needed to figure out what the hell just happened. He was in hell, in the back, belted into the back of a Lyft car, having been told his parents had their throats slit, and the sister, Romy, comes in and finds them, and their bodies were in such disfigurement. She, I guess, thought her mother was a lump of sheets or a pillow. She didn't even know her mother. That was her mother in the bed. And then she backed out of the room in shock. And then you have the brother, Jake, coming across town, trapped in the back of a car, his world just exploding.
Yeah. The shock and disorientation that, you know, just weighs so heavy on Jake, and then having to explain all this in real time and come forward and just talk about his grief that they live every single day is, it's unreal. It's traumatic.
It just strikes me as wrong, Heather, that no mention is made of Rob and Michelle. This whole hearing goes by, and it's all about his rights.
No.
Is he getting enough food? Does he have a good lawyer? It's all about them.
Today?
And I'm just, yes. And I'm just wondering, Alexis Terezchuk, at any point in this hearing, did we even hear the names Michelle or Rob ever?
No, they were never said. They were not said by the judge. They were not said by the defense attorney. They were not said by the prosecutors. And they were not said by Nick. Never once.
Alexis Terezchuk, I'm very curious because it's always an important moment to me in court when I, the prosecutor at that time, would read the indictment in a murder case. And I would look square at the defendant and name out, say out loud the victim's names and see the defendant's reaction, if any. Did Nick Reiner have any reaction in the courtroom today?
No reaction at all. Even when the judge asked him, do you understand, and he responded to him, he just simply said, yeah. He didn't even say, yes, your honor, just yeah. That was his only response. His face didn't move. He wasn't smiling. He wasn't crying. He wasn't laughing. He wasn't nervously picking at anything. He just said, yeah, in a very monotone voice.
Dr. Thomas Coyne is joining us. He is the chief medical examiner, District 2 Medical Examiner's Office in Florida. Never a lack of business there. He's a forensic pathologist, a toxicologist, a neuropathologist. Dr. Coyne, thank you for being with us. We have not obtained the full medical examiner's report yet. In fact, that's one of the reasons the defense wants a delay. They state that they don't have the medical examiner's report. Well, all they have to do is get in their car and go over to the medical examiner's office and speak to the medical examiner. They will talk to you. The doctor that performed the autopsy will speak to the defendant's counsel as long as they want to ask questions. But no, they want another delay. Based on what we know tonight, Dr. Coyne, could you describe the injuries to Rob and Michelle Reiner, including the slitting of both of their throats?
Sure. Well, the injuries were known immediately after, you know, their death. And so the autopsy report, or at least the preliminary report, was available within days. And that's why they were able to release the actual cause of death and the manner of death. And those were, you know, sharp injuries. So they were both stab wounds and cut wounds to the body that, you know, of course, led to their death. My only belief here is that if there is any additional tests that remain, it would be potentially toxicology that is delaying, you know, the finalized report, but all of the details are readily available.
Dr. Thomas Coyne, could you explain what are defensive injuries?
Sure. So we call defensive injuries wounds that appear on the backs of the hands and the arms. Generally, you know, if a person's trying to parry a blow from someone and they put their arm up to block a blow, whether it's from a fist or a foot or from a knife, and those wounds tend to occur on the backs of our arms and hands as we're trying to protect ourselves.
For instance, Dr. Thomas Coyne, a defensive injury can be found in multiple parts of the body. For instance, we know that Rob and Michelle Reiner were attacked in their sleep, in their beds, in the early morning hours, in the dark of night. Defensive wounds, if they were lying on their backs, would be, for instance, on the back of their arms. If they turned away, it could be on the back of their shoulders. It could be on their back going down their side. If they curled up in a fetal position, as I've seen many, many times, there could be defensive wounds, stab wounds on their knees, their legs where they curled up. That's what I mean by defensive wounds. Even if they turn their head and the knife hits the side of their head, that could, under certain circumstances, be considered a defensive wound. They're trying to defend themselves. As you said, on the hands, it can be like this on the back of the hands, or it could be like that on the inside of the hands. If they try to grab the knife away from their killer, they could even have knife wounds on the insides of their fingers. And a medical examiner will be able to tell that very often defensive wounds are shallow in nature as opposed to stab wounds. Is there any way, Dr. Thomas Coyne, that you can determine which wounds were first? Can you date them?
You could do your best based upon the amount of hemorrhage that's present within a wound. So, for instance, on stab wounds or incised wounds, it could be difficult if they all occur around the same time. But let's say, for instance, one of the first wounds strikes a vital organ like the heart, causing the heart to stop pumping blood. All the additional wounds that occurred after that first wound, you'd expect not to have as much hemorrhage or bleeding into those wounds because the heart isn't physically pumping blood anymore. So sometimes you could try to determine the order of injury based upon if a significant organ was hit first. So, for instance, the brain or the heart. If you have those wounds and all the additional wounds have minimal hemorrhage, it would suggest that one of those other vital organs were hit first. Otherwise, you're limited in acute, meaning injuries that just happen right away, looking at them either with their eyes or the microscope to tell how long a wound was present for. If a wound was there for days, you have a better opportunity of determining that age range. But acute or fresh injuries are sometimes very difficult to sort of group in terms of their order of occurrence.
Let me make sure that we all understand what you're saying. For instance, the first wound would bleed more. If an organ was struck, such as the heart, and there was internal bleeding or bleeding, the subsequent wounds would bleed less. And if the person is already dead, those stab wounds would bleed not at all. Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. Yes. So let's say, you know, a person first gets stabbed in the heart and that causes them to lose a large volume of blood or the heart stops beating. Any wounds that occur after that would have less blood to no blood at all because, again, the heart isn't pumping blood, sending, you know, blood to those new wounds.
And that is how, Dr. Thomas Coyne, we determine if a wound is post-mortem after death, after the heart stops beating. Go with me on this, Dr. Thomas Coyne, and tell me if I'm right or wrong. Wouldn't you think that the slits to the throats of Rob and Michelle Reiner came last? Because if they had come first, I don't see how Michelle or Rob could have fought back.
Yeah. So if you have a significant, you know, cut to the neck where you hit the carotid artery or the jugular artery, I would expect in less than 2 minutes, especially the carotid artery, less than a minute, you would be rendered unconscious because the blood loss would be so fast. And so, yes, I agree with you that if there were a lot of defensive wounds that showed evidence of injury that occurred before death, I would imagine that the injuries to the neck came last.
Joining us now, a renowned forensic psychologist, TV radio trauma expert, consultant, Karen Stark, joining us from the New York jurisdiction. You can find her at KarenStark.com. Karen, thank you for being with us tonight. I know you were watching your monitor as Dr. Thomas Coyne was describing the injuries to Rob and Michelle. And the dichotomy, it's just, as I was looking at Rob Reiner, who I actually got to meet during Dancing with the Stars, and he was very, very kind to me. Didn't have to be. That's my memory of him. Karen, looking at them in life, those videos, as I was listening to Dr. Coyne describe their injuries, the dichotomy was overwhelming to me.
And just imagine what it was like for their daughter to find them like that. Nancy, this is so much rage. When you see someone being stabbed over and over and over again, that's a personal, it's personal anger, it's rage. And clearly, I mean, this to me shows that he wanted them dead and was furious and knew what he was doing because he just kept going.
You know, you mentioned rage, Karen Stark. According to sources, he had gotten into a violent argument with his parents at Conan O'Brien's holiday party that night and stormed out of the party. The parents left after him to go try to take care of him. So the anger was there and apparent. In fact, someone said, you better call 911. It was that bad. So you're right. These wounds, as you tell it, depict rage. And there had been a horrible argument in front of everyone at the party, not anything behind closed doors. So if that happens at a party, then what happens behind closed doors? So I think you're right. I wanted to ask you about his demeanor because I got to tell you something. If you were in a stupor, let's just pretend you're in a stupor and you don't remember anything, and now you have evidence that you murdered your parents, I can't imagine getting through that without crying, without yelling out, I'm sorry, I don't remember it, I don't know what happened, I would never murder my parents, I can't believe I did this thing, something, anything. No remorse, Karen Stark.
Well, certainly, I would say that just looking at the video after he killed them and going to take a shower and the hotel and everything that he did, I don't see any remorse there at all. He's walled off now, though. This is different. He's detached. And I'm not sure what that's about, but he's not showing any emotion at all. Blank. And that's a detachment.
You know, you mentioned, Karen Stark, the video in the 7-Eleven. Let's take a look at that because you're saying that even then there was no emotion, nothing. He was just business as usual. Look, look.
Think about it, Nancy. He just killed his parents. He just killed his parents. Look at him.
The only people that had stuck by him from the beginning all the way through, footed the bill for him, and which leads me to his tell-all memoir that he is writing behind bars. Are you kidding me? That is a prosecutor's dream come true. Bye-bye, insanity defense. This guy is writing a manifesto. He is writing a book, and he is, quote, settling old scores about how badly he's been treated in Hollywood. Hold on. Karen Stark, and correct me if I'm wrong, Heather Michaels, Nick Reiner lived in his parents' pool house, a multi-million dollar setup. He had a car given to him by his parents, a credit card given to him by his parents. They filled up his gas. They paid for his food, his restaurants, everything. No job, no responsibility. When he felt like it, he could just saunter over to their kitchen and raid the Sub-Zero. Isn't that true, Heather Michaels?
It is true. He had the dream life. He had the dream life, and he threw it all away.
So, Karen Stark, what about this tell-all where he is, quote, settling old scores? What scores? What does he have to be angry about?
It's very interesting if you compare him to his brother Jake and what he wrote, because this guy, Nick, wants you to know exactly how things went for him. His side of the story, his defense. He was wronged. He was hurt. He was whatever he's saying. He doesn't mention that something horrendous has gone on, that his wonderful parents, the victims, are dead. He doesn't. That's not what it's about. It's about defending himself.
The brother writes in his essay, I still wake up every morning having to convince myself that this has really happened, that it's not a dream. This truly is my living nightmare. And Karen Stark, you are a trauma expert, a forensic psychologist. I've heard that from so many people, that they wake up in the morning and they think, oh my stars, that was awful, that dream. And then it hits them like a ton of bricks. It's real. And meantime, like we saw in that video from CBS, Nick Reiner's acting like nothing happened.
And the talk about a dichotomy, that's the most incredible thing, Nancy, the way, I mean, evidence showing that this guy absolutely knows what he's doing, where he's going, and not a hint of anxiety, remorse, nothing. And when you think about what it did to the family, because they will never, ever get over it. That's the kind of trauma that will get better over time with help, but they will never, ever resolve that.
And you know, Karen Stark, I know that the siblings' nightmare is really just beginning, because every time there's a court hearing, they have to relive it and relive it and relive it until the case is over. And really then they might start to heal. But when Jake Reiner was describing that ride over in the lift, it, you know, reminds me of moments like that in my life. And I've heard witnesses describe when they learn about the murder and then trying frantically to get to the scene. Can I fix it? Did I hear it wrong? Was that real? I don't believe it. And they start trying to rationalize everything so that it's not real. There's been a mistake. I hear that over and over and over. And he's strapped in the back of this lift car. And I can only imagine wanting to just jump out of the window.
And think about it, Nancy. It takes so long to really accept that someone's dead. And a person who's aging, and you know that they're dying, it's hard. And this is a sudden incident where both parents, both at once, are killed, they're dead, and by supposedly, allegedly, his brother. So he's stuck in that car and trying to make sense of something that he will not make sense of for the rest of his life.
Joining us, Karen Stark, renowned TV radio trauma expert and consultant, forensic psychologist. Back to Alexis Tereshchuk. How many times did the court address Nick Reiner?
Three times the judge asked him, do you understand? Do you agree to continue this case, to continue that this is not setting a date for the preliminary hearing today? We're moving it forward. He explained sort of the legalese about it. Three times, do you understand? Nick said, yeah, yeah, yeah. He never said, yes, Your Honor, yes, I understand. He just said, yeah.
You know, Philip Dubay, you're a veteran defense attorney. There have been many times in court when a defendant would speak like that to the judge, and I would turn to them and say, stand up and say, yes, Your Honor, or yes, sir, or yes, ma'am. You will not speak to the court that way. He's pretty casual.
You cannot expect every criminal defendant to speak Queen's English in open court, particularly when they're as mentally ill as Nick is. He is probably heavily medicated on antipsychotic medication, has a flat affect, it can barely say his name, let alone answer pointed questions that he's being peppered with. But the bottom line is, he did answer the questions, and whether or not you view it as being respectful or not, at least he answered. I don't think the court felt offended because the court did not respond to his affect or his responses in any negative way or fashion. So I think it's to be expected.
I cannot believe that you just said, do you expect him to speak this King's English? I assume you're referring to current King Charles in Great Britain. Actually, Yes, I do expect him to articulate in proper English because he had a job as a film producer and director and writing a screenplay. Hello, he lived in a multi-million dollar home and was surrounded by college grads and was put through one school after the next by his parents. So, yes, I expect him to stand up and say, "Yes, Your Honor," or "Yes, sir," in court. Yes, I do. And I think it was disrespectful. But he's got a whole bunch of more problems than disrespect in the courtroom. He had three opportunities to speak out in court. Three opportunities to say, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I miss my parents." And he said nothing. Not one tear. Not one apology. Nothing. Not even a sad look, for Pete's sake, Dubé.
It's not a monologue, Nancy. The court is asking you very specific questions. You answer the questions propounded. It's not your opportunity to just get up there and expatiate and talk about everything under the sun so that the world of public opinion has a different opinion of you. Remember, we're at a summary proceeding, and the nature of the proceeding is set forth by statute, and it says what, if anything, goes on. It's not a time for him to show remorse, for him to apologize to the world, for him to address the victims, or even to address the court with his true sentient feelings, if you will. It's just not the purpose of the hearing, and in fact, that could be contemptuous.
Philip Dubé, are you contesting reports that he, when he does have time to express himself and is not limited to judicial query, is writing a tell-all book about how badly he's been mistreated? If he can write a book and a screenplay, he can speak in court.
I need to see it first. And remember, we saw this with Corey
Richard.
Oh, dear
Lord in heaven.
I need to see it. I don't want to hear second and third hand hearsay about some manuscript that they're finding in a jail cell. Because believe me, if that were the case, then I think the public defender's office may have to revamp their defense. But unless and until it is made public, I have to assume it is hearsay. Well, let's just pretend it's true. If it is true, the test, Nancy, is whether or not he was NGI or insane at the time of the crime, not at the time he penned his memoir. So if at the time of the crime he could not appreciate the nature or quality of his criminal act or distinguish right from wrong, he could still meet the monotonous insanity defense and not walk, but go to a state locked hospital rather than to maximum security locked prison for life.
Philip Dubé just referred to the McNaughton rule, which is typically called the old McNaughton rule. It is the litmus test as to whether you are insane. And that is, did you know right from wrong at the time of the incident? Not today when you claim you're incompetent and cannot assist your attorney in court, not at some other time, not at some previous lockdown rehab, but at the time of the incident. Let's review. I'm so glad you brought that up, Philip. Thank you. Let's review his behavior at the time of the incident. The evening started, and Alexis, jump in if I'm wrong, the evening started with a grand party at Conan O'Brien's home, a holiday party around Christmas time. Everyone was having a good time when he, Nick Reiner, got into an argument with his parents. Isn't that true, Alexis?
It is true. They brought him to the party. They asked Conan, "Can we bring him? We've been having a lot of trouble with him." He comes to the party and he starts acting so weird. He's going up to the other celebrities and they're saying, "Why are you famous? Are you famous? What are you doing?" Everybody was so creeped out by him that they started telling his parents, "Hey, you know, what's going on here?" So Rob confronts Nick and he says, "You know, cut it out. What are you doing?" Has a big, you know, loud fight with him. People at the party were like, "Maybe we should call 911. Is this okay?" And they all storm out of the party.
They leave the party, and then that very same night, with Nick Reiner in a rage, he waits until the cover of darkness while his parents are asleep, leaves his pool house that the parents allow him to inhabit, crosses across the backyard, and every part of this is critical because it shows intent, time to form intent. He gets a weapon, a knife, from either his place or he procured it elsewhere or from his parents' kitchen. Then goes, creeps into their bedroom, they're asleep, and begins stabbing them to death in their bed. He then packs a backpack of clean clothes, leaves the home, leaves his home in the middle of the night, and goes and checks in at a waterfront hotel with a waterfront view, expensive, signs his name in, uses a credit card, does not arouse suspicion of any sort, goes to the correct room, unlocks the door, goes in, has the wherewithal to black out the windows so no one can see him or identify him. There's the inside of a room. Then takes a shower, gets all his parents' blood off his body, out of his hair, changes into clean clothes. We know this because blood was found in the shower stall. Then leaves the room with the backpack, walks to a 7-Eleven. By now, he's worked up an appetite. Goes to the refrigerated area, gets a drink, checks out, and leaves. Listen.
Michelle and Rob Reiner leave Conan's party without their son after his off-putting behavior, like wearing a hoodie to a formal event and interrupting Bill Hader's private conversation, leads to an embarrassing public row. Reiner popping up in Santa Monica at 4 a.m. Sunday morning, checking into the Pierside Hotel. Desk staff doesn't notice anything off about Reiner's appearance, but the next morning, housekeepers find sheets covering the windows and blood all over Reiner's bedding and shower.
That video of the 7-Eleven is from our friends at CBS. Are those facts accurate, Alexis Tereshchuk?
Yes, they are. This is exactly what has been reported. And we have video evidence of all of this.
So to Philip Dubay joining us, defense attorney out of this jurisdiction, L.A., why else? Let me just ask you, Philip Dubay, did you sleep in your bed last night or did you have reason to leave around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, go check into a hotel?
No, I slept comfortably in my own futon.
Did you sleep with a knife under your pillow?
No knife.
Would you agree that leaving his own home, checking into a motel, washing off blood, putting on new clothes, thinking to take a backpack, and most importantly, getting rid of the murder weapon, police still haven't found it, would indicate he knew what he did was wrong?
I think after the fact, I believe the evidence shows that he knew what he did was wrong. But Nancy, you can, and that's the criminal act that that your reporter just presented to your audience. But the truth be told, you have to also present the criminal mind. And I believe the evidence is going to show that he had multiple comorbidities, co-occurring disorders, namely some type of psychiatric disorder, namely like schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder. He probably also suffers from a personality disorder, not to mention polysubstance abuse, commonly referred to as addiction. He may be developmentally disabled, and he may have been exhibiting signs of the contraindications of mixing all his meds together. So if you have somebody who is loaded, mixing their meds, and psychiatrically disabled, it could give rise to an insanity defense. And I think what probably happened here is he went through some type of frenzied meth-induced psychosis on top of the mental illness, and he began to crash, come down, and withdraw off the drug. And then suddenly he came to his senses and he realized what he had done. But during the act itself, I do believe he was in the throes of psychosis. The question for a jury is going to be, does it rise to the level of insanity, or will he not meet that legal definition? In California, drug addiction and personality disorders can never form the basis of the type of mental illness needed to be insane at the time of a crime. While you can have a settled
bottom line, the voluntary use of drugs or alcohol, even if you are an addict, is not a defense. Voluntary use of drugs or alcohol is not a defense. And in fact, if the defense tries to suggest he has some sort of psychosis, the state, I predict, is going to argue back based on many, many scientific experiments and studies that continued voluntary use of drugs or alcohol can induce psychosis. So yeah. It's kind of on you. If you continue abusing drugs and alcohol, then commit a murder, your voluntary use of drugs or alcohol is not going to be a defense at trial. So we'll see. And wouldn't you agree, Philip Dubay, that the judge will instruct a jury that they can consider acts before, during, and after the crime to determine intent?
Of course they can. But the first thing you can bet that the public defender did is, by being locked up at Twin Towers, is that he's off all street drugs. And if you're not being treated psychiatrically, we'll see if the symptoms of mental illness emerge. And that'll show the jury at least that he was mentally ill.
That's a whole lot of ifs, Philip Dubay. Alexa Tereshchuk, bottom line, we had a preliminary hearing to set up a preliminary hearing.
Correct. And there's going to be another preliminary hearing to set up the preliminary hearing. So Nick has the whole summer. He has until September to decide with his attorney when they're going to set the preliminary hearing.
Well, I'm sure that will give him plenty of time to write his tell-all memoir, settling scores, telling all of his parents' deep, dark secrets to Heather Michaels, the family friend of the Reiners' neighbor. What deep, dark secrets? What scores does he have to settle? That is infuriating that he's trying to drag his parents through the mud so he can sell a book.
Yeah. The attention is back on him rather than the loss of two beautiful souls, his parents that were murdered in cold blood. The smug and arrogant and lack of remorse is just astounding. You know, not any mention in the courtroom or at any time that, you know, he's rethought that this was a horrible situation that unraveled. That's the conversation. That's the discussion around, you know, the people are saying that there's just such a lack of remorse and almost also a talk of resentment by him. I mean, what's up with this book? A tell-all book, really, of his parents? And so-called secrets?
You know, it's just upsetting to me, Heather, that somehow lost in the sauce are Rob and Michelle. They weren't even mentioned in court today.
Nobody's mentioned them. It's just all about Nick. And the only reason why Jake is being mentioned right now is because Jake poured his heart out into the Substack piece that he just wanted to express his sadness and the love he had for his parents and how they're just the siblings are trying to process this on the daily.
Heather Michaels is joining us, Reiner family friend and neighbor, social justice advocate, who has watched this train wreck unfold ever since the night that Rob and Michelle Reiner were murdered. Heather Michaels, thank you for being with us. Everyone, if you know or think you know anything about this case, about that evening, about the motel, anything, please call toll-free 800-222-8477. Repeat, 800-222-8477. We remember an American hero, Sergeant George Brown, Florida Highway Patrol, killed in the line of duty after 33 years on the force, leaving behind a son sentenced to life without their father, that son, Tucker. American hero, Sergeant George Brown. Thank you to our guests for being with us, but especially to you being with us tonight. Nancy Gray signing off for tonight, but I'll see you tomorrow night. And until then, good night, friend.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.